This tape is a production of All Roads Ministries. The title of this particular tape is Catholic Proofs and Claims, Part 2. This, in a certain sense, is a continuation of the first tape, which is called Catholic Proofs and Claims, and which is considered the centerpiece or the key tape of All Roads Ministries. All Roads Ministries is designed to equip the lay or clerical evangelist and apologist of Roman Catholicism with the proper tools by which he may evangelize, defend, and explain his faith to those who are not members of the Roman Catholic Church. And Roman Catholic Proofs and Claims Tape 1 does this. However, because the claims and proofs of Roman Catholicism are so universal, so well established, and so many, it is not possible to contain them simply on one tape, or, to put it another way, it is not possible to do justice to them by reducing them merely to one tape. Therefore, the existence of this tape. One point should be made. Although this tape is not designed only for use with those who wish to be or claim to be Catholics and are not Roman Catholics, that is, they wish to be Christians and are not Roman Catholics, the primary thrust of this tape is geared that way. To put it in other terms, this tape, its primary use, although not its sole use, is to acquaint those who claim to be Christians and believe or feel that they can be Christians outside the Roman Catholic Church, that the fulfillment of Christianity exists only within the Roman Catholic Church. Therefore, this tape by nature is somewhat argumentative and is certainly, in a certain sense, polemical. That is to say, it takes a point of view, defends it, and excludes the possibility of other points of view being valid. But then again, that is what the nature of truth is. With this in mind, let us outline or identify some of the proofs of Roman Catholic claims. And before I do, I guess I should make the claim as clear as possible, at least the key one that we're dealing with in this case. The Roman Catholic Church claims, and it is, to be the fulfillment of Christianity. In other words, the Roman Catholic Church was founded by Jesus on the rock of St. Peter. The Roman Catholic Church was founded by Jesus to bear witness to the truth, to be the touchstone by which men may determine whether their dogmas are correct, their behavior pleasing to God, and their own personal lives in accord with the plan of God for the salvation of men. Only the Roman Catholic Church claims and contains these truths, these characteristics, and this nature. That is the claim, and as I stated, the proofs shall follow.
Miracles.
In dealing with the subject of miracles, we should understand that from a scriptural point of view, miracles serve at least two purposes. One is clearly to express the compassion or the love of God for those creatures of His who suffer. So in other words, many of the curing miracles, that is the healing miracles, which are mentioned in the Bible, seem to have no doctrinal basis to them. But there is a second example, or second set of miracles, and this is most clearly illustrated by the story in St. Mark, in which the paralytic is lowered from the roof of a building in order that he may get close to Jesus and be healed. And Jesus tells the man that his sins are forgiven. Later, he tells him that, as he says to his questioners, which is easier, to take up thy pallet and walk, or thy sins are forgiven? Then he says, so that you will know that the Son of Man has the power to forgive sins, he tells the man, take up his pallet and walk. The man is healed. In other words, it is clear from this passage that Jesus performs the miracle as an aid to faith. that the observers of this miracle and we who hear of this miracle will understand that this miracle was a supernatural verification by God of a specific claim made by Jesus. With this in mind, it is clear that miracles today, and by miracles I mean supernatural events caused by God in a religious context which bring about some good, okay, such miracles today may have the basis that they had then, mainly to confirm doctrine, so that man may believe correctly. With this in mind, let us examine a few Roman Catholic miracles. The miracles that I shall mention in this case are miracles that are, quote, ongoing or recent. I do this only because that one may argue that an event recorded in the year 320 or 189 AD or 1215 are not credible because of the different means of history recording in those days. In other words, I do not wish to give anyone a position by which he may honestly refute the claims and the proofs established by these miracles. So therefore, I will bring up only those which are verifiable today by any person who does honestly seek the truth. The first example I will give is that of the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is contained in a cathedral in Mexico, essentially near Mexico City. The story is briefly this, that shortly after the conquest of Mexico by the Spanish conquistadors, a young Indian man was confronted by an apparition of the Blessed Mother. He was told by the Blessed Mother that he should have a certain basilica, or in this case, a church built to her honor. When he told the bishop of this, the bishop said, "I wish to see a sign," essentially a supernatural event, a miracle. When the man told this to the Blessed Mother produced for him, or directed him to, some roses which were growing at the improper time of the year. The man wrapped these in his outer garment, essentially a robe which he wore, and produced these roses for the bishop. Imprinted on the garment was an image of the Blessed Mother, now known as Our Lady of Guadalupe. It's a very commonly reproduced image, and anyone who is familiar with religious art certainly has seen it at one point or another. The point briefly is this. The image is put on the fabric of the cloth in a way unknown by man, either today or then. There are characteristics of the image which cannot have been done by men of those days and cannot be reproduced today. An attempt to destroy the cloth somewhere in the 1900s by planting a bomb in front of it was unsuccessful because the fragments of the bomb somehow hit all the area around the cloth without hitting the cloth, and the cloth, which is now almost 5 centuries old, has yet to begin to decay. All of these characteristics are miraculous. There is, of course, also the Eucharistic miracle of Lanciano, Italy. In this case, in the year 700 AD, a priest, while offering the holy sacrifice of the Mass, doubted that the bread and wine which he offered became, in physical reality, the flesh and blood of Jesus Christ. In order that this man's faith would not be weakened or troubled by doubts, Jesus allowed at this point the flesh to become physically the body of Jesus, and the blood to be a measurable, understandable, scientifically verifiable blood instead of merely blood under the appearances of wine. These substances have been preserved without artificial means until today. And in an examination done by Italian medical scientists in the 1970s showed that the flesh is from the heart of a human with AB positive blood type, and the blood is of the same person, or at least the same type. that the flesh was is from the heart, produced, that is, separated from the heart in some fashion which cannot be reproduced. In other words, there are not cut marks or surgical marks. These alone, the production of it is miraculous, the preservation of it is miraculous, and the measurement in the way that the scientists did, which shows that this could not be done by known medical technology, which certainly is superior today on the area of surgery than it was in the year 700 AD, is again a miracle. Another miracle would be, of course, the dancing sun at Fatima, which was witnessed by approximately 50 to 70,000 people in the year 1917 and reported in the national and international media at the time. The reason these people were present at Fatima at that time is because the Blessed Mother was appearing to three children in Fatima, Portugal, and had promised them a great sign. Another miracle, of course, is the liquefaction of the blood of St. Janarius, which happens in the Cathedral of Milan on St. Janarius' feast day. Again, this goes on now. Another series of miracles, which are given only to Catholics, are the incorruptibles. That is to say that when the person who, for various different reasons, is given this privilege dies, his or her body does not corrupt in a normal fashion, but remains in some degree of preservation without artificial means. One of the more famous recent ones is Bernadette Soubirous, who died, I believe, in 1872, but whose body has yet to show any signs of decay whatsoever. Another example of a miracle is astigmatism. In this case, a person receives the stigmata, that is, the wounds of Jesus, some or all, mainly the pierced hands, the pierced feet, the crown of thorns, injuries, and the piercing of the breast, the side. One of the most recent and famous and verifiable stigmata was Padre Pio, who died, I believe, in 1968 and lived in southern Italy. I mention him because 1968 was not that long ago. The holes in Padre Pio's hands were so pronounced that one could look right through them. And yet, although Padre Pio suffered apparently the pains of the wounds of Christ, and these wounds did not heal, but stayed in a neither putrefying nor healing state for a significant period of time, again, which is miraculous. Let me now tie these miracles in, and of course there are only a few, to Roman Catholicism. Padre Pio was an active Roman Catholic priest in union with Rome. He taught Roman Catholic doctrine. He celebrated the sacrifice of the Mass. He heard confessions. He gave last rites. All of those activities are thereby confirmed by Padre Pio's miraculous status. The message of Fatima was, among other things, pray the rosary, attend Mass, be loyal and pray for the Holy Father, that is to say the Pope, and do reparation for the souls who suffer in purgatory. The message of the Lanciano Eucharistic miracle is certainly the real presence, the reality of it, the propriety of believing that the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass is a reproduction of the Holy Sacrifice of Calvary. Again, Roman Catholic doctrines. The image of Our Lady of Guadalupe was again a verification of the Roman Catholic doctrine of the veneration of the Blessed Mother of God. And the incorruptibility of Bernadette Soubirous confirms her specific revelation, which was given to her by the Blessed Mother, that the Blessed Mother was, in fact, immaculately conceived, which, of course, is a Roman Catholic doctrine. One must come to one of two conclusions in dealing with these miracles. Either God deceives us, in which case we can believe nothing, and certainly not be Christians, because the Christian God can neither be deceived nor deceive, or God is confirming specific Roman Catholic doctrines with the intention that they be believed. And since they are specific Roman Catholic doctrines, it follows of necessity that therefore the Roman Catholic Church teaches the truth. And if God did not want us to affirm our belief in that church, then what we would have is a God who is deceiving us. Again, an impossibility. So the miracles which have occurred, which are verifiable by a 20th century researcher today, who simply wishes to take the time and effort to discover them, confirm that the Catholic Church is today, was yesterday, and will be tomorrow, the true Church of Jesus Christ. And that is proved by miracles.
The activities of the worshiper of Satan.
One can sometimes determine who one is or what side one is on by looking at whose one's enemies are. In other words, if the enemies of God oppose you, then it is because you are on the side of God. And anyone, again, who wishes to do the research will determine that the Satanists, that is, those who are the worshippers of Satan, who by definition are the most implacable foes of the God that we adore, attack the Roman Catholic Church, not only as a matter of formality, since the Roman Catholic Church teaches a morality which the Satanists reject, but also in its ritual and its doctrine. The point I make out is this. The Satanists, when they perform their Black Mass, and that is the name of the sacrilegious rituals that they perform, do a parody, an abomination, a mocking of a Roman Catholic Mass, not of a fundamentalist Bible study, or not of a Quaker meeting. They ignore those as being irrelevant. In these Black Masses, they use Latin, usually distorted, used in a mocking way, because Latin is the official language of the Church of God, that is to say, the Roman Catholic Church. And in these Black Masses, or even in other ritual ceremonies, the key element, the most prized element that they can have at these mocking anti-God ceremonies is a consecrated host, that is to say, a host consecrated by a priest of God, which of course means from a Roman Catholic priest, from a Roman Catholic Church. If we follow logically, therefore, that the enemy of God would attack most vehemently that which is closest to God, which contains most of his truth and most of his power, then we come to the unavoidable conclusion that it is the Roman Catholic Church that the Satanists war against, because it is the Roman Catholic Church which represents God on earth, which is another way of saying that this is a proof that the Roman Catholic Church is true Christianity.
A foot in both camps.
This term, which represents the Roman Catholic proof, is one given to me by the Catholic author Richard Colin Guido. And I acknowledge my debt to him at this time. Essentially, the Roman Catholic Church manages to span the two extremes of human behavior. The Roman Catholic Church requires of its most holy saints, its most sanctifying people, its most sacrificial people, that is to say, those people who live almost entirely for God, who give up almost everything for God, who live their entire lives for the glory of God and the benefit of their fellow man. The Roman Catholic Church requires of them still yet more. The Roman Catholic Church is never satisfied with perfection. By the same token, the Roman Catholic Church includes in its ranks those who break almost all the laws of God and man. Those who get angry at the Church, stay away from the sacrifice of the Mass, ignore the other sacraments for years at a time, and yet on their deathbed call for the priest. These people who live a reprobate life, a bad life, who as much as they can seem to us to be evil people, are lumped within the same organization as the St. Bernards, the St. Francis's of Assisi, the St. Theresa's of Avila, and the Mother Teresa of Calcutta. The great sacrifices for God are linked with those who ignore God almost all of their lives in the same organization. But then again, didn't Jesus say that if he were to be lifted up, he would draw all men to him? He does. And the interesting point about it is this. The St. Bernards of Clairvaux, the St. Francis of Assisi, do not resent those who make the deathbed conversion, who come back to the church at the last moment. In other words, only the Roman Catholic Church manages to span all of human behavior and have room under its roof for all those, the good, the bad, the not so good, the fanatical, the lukewarm, and others. And this is done without somehow the church splitting into a schism, without somehow the church having to choose one side or the other, without the church having to say to those who seek the role of sanctity, there's no need for you to do so. And yet the church does not say to those who despair, go away, it's too late for you to repent. In other words, the church says two things which in any human institution would split that human institution, which would divide that human institution, which would destroy that human institution. And what those two things the church says is, almost anything is good enough, and almost nothing is good enough. There is almost nothing you can do that will drive you away from this organization. And there is almost nothing you can do, no matter how marvelous, no matter how self-sacrificial, no matter how heroic, that makes you one of our great heroes. And that's the point. This organization, which has existed spanning with a foot in both camps, the totality of human nature, can only do this if there is a guiding spirit in it to sustain it throughout this experience. Without division, without rancor, and continuously in love. And that is the supernatural presence of the Holy Spirit guiding and sustaining this organization in a way that no human organization could possibly survive.
Bad leaders.
This is a rather common argument, and people usually use it rather flippantly, but I think it's a quite serious one. One should acknowledge, when one studies the history of Roman Catholicism, that there have been two specific periods in which the papacy, specifically, was held by men of rather low character. One was before the time of the Cluniac Reform, that is to say, around the end of the first millennium, around the year 1000, and the second was during the time of the High Renaissance. At this time, the papacy became, almost in essence, a political office or a social office. In other words, it was held by men whose particular character, whose organizational abilities, whose desire to preserve and advance the truth of Jesus Christ was not outstanding, and whose personal life gave evidence that they suffered from severe moral defects. This is not the time and the place to judge whether these men ultimately received salvation or damnation. That time and place is at the end of time, and the judgment is not done by us. But the point is quite simply this. One will notice, particularly in 20th century America, that organizations which are allegedly religious in nature cannot survive the failing of one major leader. To use one more of the recent examples, the People's Temple of Jim Jones in Guyana lost all of its status, not only because it murdered its people, but because of Jim Jones. The fall of other famous Protestant evangelists have reduced their organizations to either mere shadows of what they were or absolutely nothing. If one reads the history of the United States, one will find that during the great religious revivals of the 1830s, there were many, many famous people who had large followings. There were organizations, in fact, entire communities set up to follow religious principles, which at that time, so we are led to believe, their adherents felt would sweep the nation and conquer the world for Jesus. Today, they are footnotes in rather obscure and esoteric history books, because they could not survive one or two bad leaders. But the Roman Catholic Church has survived numerous bad leaders in succession. There have been times, again, if one wishes to read history, when one will determine that the level of the priesthood in various different countries was quite poor, and the level of the episcopacy, that is, the bishops, was quite poor. At various different times throughout medieval history, over the conflict of lay investiture, bishops were, to a high degree, appointed by kings. In other words, they were appointed for their military ability or their ability to gather taxes, not because of their commitment to the Church of Jesus Christ. Yet, throughout all this time, the Roman Catholic Church has grown. The Roman Catholic Church has been associated with, in popular history, dictators and oppressive systems. This is not necessarily true, but by the same token, even if it were true, it would only again establish that the bad reputation of the Roman Catholic Church, which has sometimes been associated with the Roman Catholic Church in the common mind, has never driven the common person away. The places where Roman Catholicism was established and lost its adherence are those places where those people were persecuted or slaughtered out of the Roman Catholic Church. In other words, Protestantism and Islam, which conquered some areas that previously had been Roman Catholic, did so only by the power of the sword, never by the power of persuasion. In the same sense that no communist government has ever been elected in a free democratic election, in the same token, no people, once they have become Roman Catholic, have ever chosen voluntarily to leave it, despite the fact that frequently the Roman Catholic Church has been plagued, or one might even say bothered or degraded, by bad leadership. Those who should set the highest example have sometimes set the lowest. Again, this does not occur with normal human institutions. Normal human institutions can seldom survive one bad leader. To survive two or three or four in succession at the time of major social upheaval such as the Protestant Reformation would not be conceivable if we understand the normal workings of history and human nature. So the fact that the Catholic Church has had bad leaders at bad times and still survived, grown, and kept the loyalty of its adherents means that it has an extra ability to do so, mainly the presence of God keeping it throughout history unassailable by the gates and powers of hell.
A seeker of truth and not fearful of it.
By definition, a Christian must be one who has a special relationship with truth. If one examines the various different denominations in churches which claim to be Christian, one will find only one which has, in its entire history, sought out, advocated, and exercised the pursuit of truth in all fields, in all endeavors, at all times, and that is the Roman Catholic Church. The university system, which presently dominates the higher educational system of the Western world, was and is a creation of the Roman Catholic Church. Modern scientific method, the rules of logic, the transmission to the modern world of the rules of Aristotle and the thoughts of Plato are because of the Roman Catholic Church. This is not the time to go into the history of Western intellectual thought, but if one wishes to do so, one will find that from the very beginning, the concept of truth has been treasured, sought, nurtured, and encouraged by the Roman Catholic Church. While all other institutions which claim to be truthful or claim to be a seeker of truth have always, at one point or another, prevented their people from seeking truth in certain areas, have denied their minds inquiry, have demanded that they enslave their intellects to certain positions which by definition are always anti-truthful. They sometimes call them paradoxical, but in fact they are simply lies. The point is that the anti-intellectualism of the fundamentalist movement is not a new concept. It goes back to the first major heresy in the Catholic Church, which was Gnosticism, which was denial of reality and a denial of truth. The Catholic Church affirms reality, confirms truth, confirms the seeking of it. No other institution does, and that is the sign why it is the fulfillment of Christianity.
Catholic truth and claims. Take
2, side 2.
The Bible and the Church.
As silly as this may seem to some of you, and perhaps someone listening to this tape might have actually believed what I'm going to say until they understand it, the Bible did not create the Church, but the Church created the Bible. This does not mean to say that the Bible is not an inspired book. It does not mean to say that the ultimate author is not God. Of course the Bible is inspired, and of course the author of the Bible is God. But God used man to write the Bible. He used various different candidates whom he selected from among all mankind. He inspired certain men to write things down in certain ways. Now, the history of the Bible has shown that the form in which we use it now took place roughly at the end of the 4th century, that is in the 390s and the early 400s. Up until then, there were many candidates, so to speak, of different works which were included in, quote, the Bible by some various church groups or contending factions and not others. It was only in its final form accepted at that time and confirmed by the Roman Catholic Church. The point is this. Every Christian, by definition, sees a special relationship between the Bible and the Church. In other words, there is a correspondence, an important, significant, causal relationship between the two. The Bible should certainly confirm church doctrines and point the inquiring seeker of faith in the right direction to determine what the truth is. The church certainly has the obligation of preserving, interpreting, and spreading the Bible. Also, by definition, since the church founded by Jesus existed before the Bible, the church has the obligation of determining exactly what the Bible is and what it is not. In other words, the authority over the Bible must reside in an institutional, hierarchical church, because only institutional and hierarchical churches can make decisions. This might be so simple that most people have not understood it. The concept of the church as a vague collection of people who somehow have some type of vague beliefs held in common is total nonsense. This is a word used by media spokesmen when they simply don't know what other word to use. People who have some similar beliefs in common are religious people, that is, people motivated by religious beliefs, but they are not part of an organization, and only an organization can determine a book. A book requires an author and an editor and a publisher, otherwise it does not exist. The author of the Bible is God, but the publisher and the editor of the Bible must be a hierarchical institutional church which can make binding decisions which bind that institution forever. Now, that can only happen if the church is infallible, if we are talking about a matter of Christianity. It can only happen also if the church has a continued existence from the time of the canonization of the book, that is to say, of the determination what was in the Bible, and this is a key point, existed before that time. Even the most violent enemies of the most violently anti-Catholic enemies, those who will die rather than become members of the Roman Catholic Church, not out of a sheer conviction of truth, of course, but out of a sheer hatred of God and truth, even they will admit that the Roman Catholic Church existed at least back to the 320s AD. So it was, in fact, the Roman Catholic Church which determined what the Bible was and authorized its publication, its use, its determination of its contents. Therefore, if the Bible has has a unique place in Christianity, if it has an important place in Christianity, if it has an essential place in Christianity, and many people hold that it does, then it can get there only by the authority of an institution which speaks on behalf of God and an institution through which God speaks. If this determination of this essential role is determined by God and not by man. Now, if it is determined only by man, then the Bible has an essential role only because men say so, and we have reduced Christianity to a form of democracy. If this central role of the Bible is determined by God's activities, then he must be acting through his chosen instrument, mainly the church he has created, the church he has guided, and the church he empowers, and the church he keeps alive throughout the ages. The true church must have preceded the Bible. And although, if one wishes to study history, one will find that there were various organizations that did, at one time or another, exist prior to the year 320, none of those organizations, we're talking in a religious context here, exist today, except for the Roman Catholic Church. And none of those other organizations, even if they existed around the time of the canonization of the Bible, claim to have written it or have authority for it or any other necessary qualifications by which one can use the Bible to determine the identity and the nature of the true church of Jesus Christ. So if one accepts the Bible as being important in Christianity, one must perforce accept the proper role of the Roman Catholic Church. That is to say, the Roman Catholic Church's role as the church of Jesus Christ throughout the ages, one, indivisible, entire, and unchanging. Or one must reject truth as a possible and necessary characteristic of Christianity. And if one rejects truth, one rejects God and can no longer claim to be a Christian. So quite frankly, it is either the Roman Catholic Church or no Christianity whatsoever.
Chosen people analogy.
One of the characteristics of Christianity is that it is historical. In other words, we believe that God's salvation history, his plan by which man is to be saved, is worked out through history, through a progressive set of events and truths revealed by God through man, and that some of these events are recorded in the sacred books of the Bible. It is clearly understood also, by definition, that up until the time of Jesus, the chosen people of God were those people that we now call the Jews, sometimes also referred to as the Israelites and the Hebrews. In other words, God singled a particular group of people, a particular nation, those people who were descendant from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Those people were to be the means by which God was to make his truths known throughout history, throughout time, and throughout the population of the world. One, if one accepts, as St. Augustine says, that the Old Testament and the New Testament have the relationship to one another, that the New Testament is the Old Testament unveiled, and that the Old Testament has things to teach us, therefore, then this concept of a chosen people, a new chosen people, would be carried through New Testament times. And if one examines the history of the Old Testament chosen people and the history of the New Testament chosen people, that is to say the history of the Jews, Israelites, Hebrews, the terms I don't get upset if you interchange them, and the history of the Roman Catholic Church, which are the new chosen people, then one finds striking analogies far beyond the possibility of coincidence. And remember, our God is the God of history. Things do not happen historically by accident in a Christian context. God reveals things, points out things, indicates things, and tells things, so that history may be relied on as a source of truth for us. As I stated before, the Roman Catholic Church is a seeker of truth, not an evader of truth. It is an interesting position, an interesting fact, that most non-Catholics not only know very little of history, but will study almost none. And when they do study history, it will always be from anti-Catholic sources, never from objectively verifiable sources. Perhaps the word never is extreme here. I should say seldom. This is because they generally reject history. They reject the view of the progressive revelation of God through mankind. But that is the nature of the new chosen people and the old chosen people. This entire concept is dealt with at greater length in a separate tape available from ORM called The New Chosen People. And in that case, the analogies are specified further and the approach, the proof, is dealt with further and developed further. I would suggest at this time that if you wish to pursue your study of this further, that you would obtain that tape.
The incarnational nature of Christ and the Church.
The incarnation is the term we give to the act by which Jesus, the second person of the Blessed Trinity, eternal God, true God, became man, true man. That is to say, in the one person Jesus, the two natures, divine and human, were combined. The incarnation is a miracle, a mystery, an activity of God in which God interposes or interferes into the nature of man, interfering, thank God, for our benefit so that salvation and redemption are possible. The point is this. Without the incarnation, without Jesus being both true God and true man, Christianity does not exist. Now, understanding this, that the incarnation is in a very real sense the union of God, who is pure spirit, with man, who is both spirit and flesh, we understand what Christianity is. Christianity is that union of spirit and flesh. God created us both flesh and spirit, body and soul. Therefore, both the body and the soul, the flesh and the spirit, must be inherently good. Therefore, a religion that does not deal with both aspects, that does not contain both aspects in its doctrines, in its rituals, in its behavior, in its philosophy, in its morality, cannot be incarnational. And if it is not incarnational, then it falls into one of the basic heresies, either to deny the divine nature of Jesus or to deny his human nature. In a very real sense, the Church is Jesus still with us. Not only in the real presence when he appears to us under the Blessed Sacrament, physically, visually, sensually, but also in the sense of that the Church is the continuation of Jesus on earth. It does what Jesus did, teaches the truth, brings grace, brings comfort, and guides us to heaven. Confirms us, guides us, admonishes us, forgives us. As Jesus says in Mark, the Son of Man has the power to forgive sins. And as he says in the Gospel of St. John, receive ye the power to forgive sins by the Holy Spirit. Whose sins you shall forgive, they are forgiven. Whose sins you shall retain, they are retained. In other words, Jesus, throughout his entire ministry, throughout the entire Scriptures, combines this incarnational nature, spirit and flesh together. This is the hallmark of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is nothing if it not incarnational. And almost all of the heresies ultimately are those that go from one extreme to the other, either all flesh or all spirit. Look at the contenders for the title of Christianity or Christ's true church. There are those who believe that the spirit is so important that one does not have to say on one's lips what one really means. That what one does with one's body has no effect on one's eternal salvation. Sins of the flesh mean nothing. words on the mouth mean nothing. What one learns, what one does, mean nothing. Only thing that matters is some vague, indefinable, spiritual, mystical relationship with some thing called Jesus, who requires nothing of you as far as your flesh goes. And then, of course, there are the other extremes. Those who believe that it doesn't matter what you believe, it doesn't matter what you teach, as long as one lives the righteous life. In other words, they believe that simply living a good life, simply acting with one's hands, simply adhering to the basic precepts of natural reason reflected in one's basic morality is enough. Because after all, one does not have to give one's mind and soul to Jesus. We have these extremes reflected throughout Protestantism. Sometimes they are reflected within the same denomination, which schizophrenically teaches one emphasis today and another emphasis tomorrow, whatever, they're combining the two. Even then, they understand that both are necessary, but they do not combine them. Look briefly at the Roman Catholic sacraments. In every sacrament, there is an aspect of a physical and a spiritual component. Water, oil are used in sacraments. The very flesh of Jesus is received physically in the Eucharist. For confession, one must say verbally what one has done. One must move one's lips. And of course, the Catholic Church does not recognize a marriage as being fully consummated until there has been a physical union between the man and his wife. These are the physical aspects. By the same token, in every case, there is grace. There is the commitment of heart. There is the necessary status of being in the proper intention, the mental activity for the proper reception of the sacraments. Again, the combination of spirit and the combination of body. The combination of both. This is the same Jesus who fed the 5,000 because they were hungry, fed them real food, fed them fish, fed them bread. But yet when he spoke to the woman at the Samaritan well and said, "There is a well which you drink from, you will never be thirsty again," the woman understood him to be talking about a physical well. And when Jesus said, "I am that well," we don't really know how she exactly understood that. Again, notice the analogy that Jesus has used. Drink from him, and you will never grow thirsty. Notice the analogy constantly about never dying, but living forever. Notice the analogies Jesus uses, always combining always the flesh and the spirit. He tends both. Take up my burden, and you will find it pleasant. Come to me, you who weary and are heavy of heart. Notice the concept of heavy of heart. One's heart doesn't get heavy. One's spirit doesn't get overburdened. Because these are combinations of physical and spiritual things. But they do if one is incarnational. That is why we Catholics say it is so important that you physically attend Mass, that you physically genuflect at the right time, that you physically make the sign of the cross when you begin prayers or enter a church. That is why it is important to use physical holy water. That is why we put the veneration of the physical relics and at the same time emphasize silent prayer, mental communion, mystical unions with God, spiritual values. These things mean that God wants us to behave both physically and spiritually correctly combined, because, as was once said, all God wants from all of us is all of us. And all of us means body and soul. Take another aspect of the concept of the incarnation. Although Jesus lived once on earth in the way that we live now, although he also died once on Calvary for all of us, in the sense that his life and his death was for all of us, If it is not extended through time, then, in a certain sense, it was a single event, done over with, forever, and he is not physically present with us forever throughout time. But he stated that he would. He stated that if he had lifted up, he would draw all men to him. Now, this could mean, certainly, a figurative lifting up. But to we Catholics, we also understand this to mean when the host is lifted up at Mass, then Jesus is lifted up, shown physically to all men. The incarnational church, the Roman Catholic Church, extends the incarnation throughout all time so that all men, in one fashion or another, may have the opportunity to come to Calvary, to come to Bethlehem, that is to say, to come to the Mass. In a certain sense, Jesus becomes available to all. Now, I say in a certain sense here in the word all, because by definition, the Roman Catholic Church is not physically present in every single small hamlet or every single remote village throughout the world. Nor does the Mass have the permission of the authorities to be sacrificed, to be presented in certain areas, so it's done in secret. And if it's done in secret, by definition, it is not available to all, but only to the select people who know about it. This is why I say in a certain sense, this is the qualification I make. And this is not the point to deal with the concept of what happens to the people who, because of the place they were born or the time they were born, did not have access to acknowledge and join the Roman Catholic Church. That topic is dealt with in the tapes available from this organization entitled The Last Judgment and Limbo. What I'm saying is this. The Roman Catholic Church does, however, maintain the presence of Christ, extending the incarnation throughout history, from the time of Christ till the end of the world. No other church even claims this. Notice the terms used in other churches. They feel the Spirit of God moving. Notice they feel, they don't see. It becomes a totally emotional, a totally, if it were to be correct, a totally spiritual thing. There is no physical aspect to it at all. Or, by the other hand, we have those who tell us how they heard the words of Jesus the night before. Jesus came in and sat on the man's bed, spoke to him, talked to him, told him exactly what to do, called him up on the telephone. The physical contact. But then again, what we usually have in a situation like this is no combination of that with the Spirit of God. Only in the Catholic Church do we find the Spirit of God, the proper teaching, combined with the acknowledgement of the body as being essential to what one does. Notice, in Matthew 25, Jesus says, if you feed me, if you visit me, if you clothe me when I am distressed, when you do this for the least of me, you do this for me, you will be rewarded. But it also says that you must listen to the gospel, accept its truth, and be baptized. The only way to reconcile these two passages is to understand the nature of the incarnation as properly understood in Christianity. In other words, that it requires a commitment and an activity of body, and a disciplining and a commitment and a loving of the mind. That is the incarnation. That is the message of Christianity. And that is the approach of Jesus to us. And that is the characteristic of the Roman Catholic Church, which is shared by no other church. No other church whatsoever comes close. That is to say, if the incarnation is important to Christianity, and it is, if the incarnation is essential to Christianity, and it is, and if the incarnation was not simply a specific event for 33 years in the history of the world, but something that is to be continued throughout the history of mankind, and one must hold that if you think about it and reason about it for any time at all, then only the Roman Catholic Church fulfills this function of maintaining God throughout, of sustaining God, of being sustained and maintained by God, of being the instrument of the incarnation throughout history. That is the Roman Catholic Church, and that is a proof for the validity of the Roman Catholic Church.
The claim of infallibility.
The Catholic Church claims to be infallible. Now, it is true that there were various small denominations and cults which appear to also claim infallibility. But when we're talking about the claims of Christianity, we have to deal with serious claims, not silly ones. The claim of infallibility is, briefly, this: that the Roman Catholic Church has not erred, is not erring, and cannot err on serious matters of faith and morals. In other words, is an unfailing guide for those who seek the truth and wish to approach God by means of truth. If the Catholic Church claims this and no other does, then if infallibility becomes a necessary characteristic of the true church of Jesus, the true Christian church, that is, then the Catholic Church is the only one which fulfills the role of being infallible. Because by definition, one cannot be infallible by accident, but must acknowledge and claim the infallibility which is necessary. Examine, if one will, from an argument of necessity, the situation which would arise if a church of Jesus was not infallible. If the church of Jesus were not infallible, we would have a situation where God would therefore allow a man in good conscience to seek the church as his guide in matters of faith and morals, and to be honestly misled. In other words, he could be led into error, seeking and believing, trusting and joining the true church of Jesus. If this were possible, then we would have a God who would knowingly, consciously, deliberately, and intentionally lead man into non-truth when man seeks truth. If one can believe this, then one cannot be a Christian. But to hold the opposite, therefore, that the church which men rely on, which men seek, which men trust, which men literally place their chances of salvation on, for men to follow a church like this, and for God to encourage men to do so, and remember, we're talking about the true church of God, the church that Jesus will lead men to, if they seek, if they ask, if they pray. That church, therefore, must be infallible. And, again, if it is infallible, it must know it. It must claim it. It must acknowledge it. This might be considered what is called, in philosophical services, a ontological proof. But it is, nonetheless, still valid. There are related tapes available from this organization in which some of the issues and suggestions and ideas raised in these tapes are developed either from a different aspect or in greater depth. And a companion piece to this tape, as mentioned before, is Roman Catholics Claims 1. Other tapes which you might find interesting are The Last Judgment, Faith and Hope, Basic Theology 1, The Papacy, The Eucharist, Infallibility, Knowledge, Elements of Logic, Miracles, and The Bible and the Church. This is not to say that any of the other tapes would not be of use to you. This is simply to say that, in my opinion, these tapes are the most directly related to the subject matter raised in this discussion. Again, I would like to say that these arguments raised were not designed to offend anyone, but designed to equip those who are already in the faith to aid you in leading others to the true faith, and to challenge those of you who are not within the fold of Roman Catholicism to examine your reasons on why you are not. Because if the Catholic Church is true, then your relationship to it will be the single most important determining factor in your salvation. And your salvation is the only thing that really matters in your entire life. Additional copies of this tape, or any tape mentioned, may be obtained by writing to All Roads Ministries, 38 Charlotte Grove, Hopewell Junction, New York, 12533. And if you write us, we'll be quite happy to send you a catalog, along with your order, which will give you a listing of the current products that we have available.